May it be a joyous week, an inspirational week, a happy week, a week in which we'll only have good news to share with Yetzer Hashem. Over these last few weeks, as we kind of get together in person, we started having these Zoom Havdalahs and a little bit of a the Fabrengen. I thought it was just going to be the special weeks of the Fabrengen. But Fabi already told me. He told me it has to be a Fabrengen every week. I want to share a story with you, as is customary. The story of the Holy Baal Shem Tov. And a few words of Torah. I guess it qualifies as what they call a Shtikel Fabrengen. Really, to Fabreng means to spend time together. And since we can't spend time together in close physical proximity, we can still be socially engaged, and we could spend time together. So, the story that I'm going to share with you is a little bit connected to some of the things you may have seen on social media lately. It's very much connected to the Torah ideas I'm going to share, and by extension, some of what's going on today in the social media world and in the Jewish world at large. So the story goes that there was an orphan couple, and they lived in this shtetl, and it so happened that this orphan boy and this orphan girl, who were not related in any way, shape, or form, but ended up working for their common employer, and as they say, there was a boy, there was a girl, it was Gvarna Shidduch. They kind of got interested in each other. It wasn't like today's day and age. They didn't go to Yorkville and hang out or anything, but they decided it would be a good idea to maybe think about getting married. They had similar backgrounds. He had no parents. She had no parents. Anyway, as they say in Yiddish, it says, Gevorah Nashidach. They decided they were going to get married. Now, their common employer was a very, very generous and kind person. He decided that he would pay for the wedding. He would pay for the wedding. Yosem and Yisemet, it's a very big mitzvah. Achnasas Kala in general is a big mitzvah to help people make a wedding, but especially here where there was an orphan, two orphans, makes it an exceptional mitzvah. And so he decided that he would pay for the wedding, and he gave this young man and young woman a sizable amount of money, and he said, go to town and buy the things that you will need to be able to set up a home. Whatever they need, a quilt, some kind of mattress. I'm sure the flatware was not exactly beautiful silver or china, but enough to be able to have a modest dwelling together. I'm saying that this is connected to this time, because you may have seen this article, I think in the Times of Israel was the last place I saw this, but it's in Yiddish it's called a Schwarze Chasana, it's called a black wedding. And a black wedding in Yiddish euphemism meant at a time of an epidemic, that they would make a wedding between an orphan boy and an orphan girl, and the merit of doing this mitzvah would bring about good things for the community and society at large. And the story goes that in the 1918 Spanish epidemic, this was actually done by the Jewish community in Yerushalayim. There was social distancing, whatever they called it at the time. They weren't allowed to be together, and there was a whole story how they put this wedding together, but they did make a wedding like this, and shortly afterward the epidemic dissipated. So it definitely can't go wrong by helping orphans get married. You can't go wrong with that. Whether or not it's going to end this whole COVID mishigas, I don't know, this disaster we're dealing with, but this is what's being talked about now. And we believe in the power of mitzvahs, and we believe in the power of Yiddishkeit, and who knows? Could be. This is the thing that's needed to bring about an avalanche of a difference. this whole situation came really almost out of nowhere. Although when you have the hindsight in 2020, people could start to predict, and the people say they could have seen this happening, but I don't know. I didn't hear this from somebody else. I was living here as you were living in this world, and we didn't see it happening. We didn't see it coming. I remember even Purim, there was one shul in Toronto that closed, and it was like this mystery. You couldn't believe it. A shul would close on Purim, like we canceled the Purim activities. What's going on? We couldn't wrap our heads around it. Less than a week later, everything was shut down in town. Anyway, so the story goes that this very, very generous employer gives them this sizable amount of money, and the young couple sets out for the big town where they could purchase these things. And on the way, there was a little bit of forest you had to go through in this area of, somewhere on the Russo-Polish border that was always switching back and forth, but at that time it was under Polish dominion. And they were waylaid in the forest by a group of bandits. No, I'm sorry. Sorry. Story, they got through the forest, no problem. And they come to town. And they come to town and they hear this tumult. A big tumult going on. And they said, what's all the excitement about? And they said that there's this family that had rented a property from the local landowner, the local duke, local squire, in Yiddish or Polish, it's called a paretz. And they couldn't make payments. And because they couldn't make the payments, they were now being thrown into a pit. A pit was the euphemism for the dungeons that these landowners, who had tremendous power, they had their own little armies, their own little police force. They really reported to nobody. They could do as they pleased. Poland did not have a formal royal family. There were various dukes, the archdukes, and various nobility, members of nobility, and a member of nobility would be chosen to be the king of Poland, but it wasn't passed on necessarily from parent to child. And some of these squires or dukes wielded enormous power over enormous swaths of Poland, and some of them were very small little fiefdoms. Maybe they had a small troop of armed soldiers, and they were essentially the de facto ruler in the area in which they resided. As long as they didn't start up with the king, they could really do as they pleased. And they did. And the Jewish people were at their mercy, as were many of the Polish peasants, the serfs. And if these people were dissolute individuals, most of them, they were not necessarily refined individuals, they were party animals. And they made a living simply because they owned everything. So they would have people rent out the properties, lease the properties, and they would get paid. And they don't have to do anything to make a living. The problem was, of course, when you couldn't make the payments. So we have this couple, family, actually a whole family that's now being led into a deep dungeon, a deep pit. And there's nobody has to guard the place because you can't escape. You're thrown deep into the ground. There are no windows. Once a day, food is thrown down. Either the food is thrown or it is not thrown. When a family went into a situation like this, a pit like this, you either did come out or didn't come out. It was not a good circumstances. Very, very, very dismal circumstances. And this is what's happening. There's this Jewish family that's being led into this grub, as they called it in Yiddish, this pit. So the young man and woman looked at each other, and they said, how can we go and make a wedding and celebrate when there's a Jewish family that's literally going to be ruined, and maybe even, who knows, they might even die. So they said, how much money do they owe? They said, oh, it's a huge amount of money, it's a whole year's lease. How much money is it? So it turned out that the money that was required was just about exactly the money that this very, very generous employer had given them to make a wedding. And the young man looked at the young woman, and the young woman looked at the young man, and they said, you know what? How could we think about ourselves and prepare for our future life when we know that we were here, we had cash in hand, and together they decided that come what may, if they wouldn't be able to get married and set up home, then it would be delayed. They could not turn their backs on the need of this very, very destitute and unfortunate family. And so they came forward and they said, we can pay. Who are you? It doesn't matter who we are. We have cash, and they had a bag of money, and they paid the Duke's representatives, and the family was set free. And they ran away before anybody could thank them. They don't want to be thanked, they don't want the attention, they don't want to be put in an uncomfortable position. And most importantly, they didn't feel really, it was almost not their money. The money was given to them for a specific purpose, and maybe the landowner would be upset. And they figured, listen, we had to do what we had to do. And if the landowner will not give us more money, we understand. He's not obligated to give us anything. He's under no obligation. So they came home and they couldn't bring themselves to tell the truth because they felt uncomfortable. So they lied. They said that we were waylaid. A group of bandits in the forest came and stole all the money. We're terribly sorry. We're happy we escaped with our lives. And don't feel obligated. It's not your problem. It's not your issue. It's an act of God. Maybe we weren't supposed to be able to set up a family. Maybe we weren't supposed to be have a marriage. Who knows? The employer was a very, very, very generous and sensitive man, and he thought to himself, how can I look at this young man and woman that had such unfortunate circumstances, and they were waylaid, and they were robbed. How can I go around living? And he literally scraped the bottom of his barrel and gave whatever he had. He said to the couple, I guess I was supposed to lose the other money, and I want you to have a wedding. For me, it's very important you both work for me. It'd be a big privilege for me that you'll have this wedding. And he gave them almost an equal sum of money he had given them originally. They were, of course, totally overwhelmed and very, very touched. They couldn't thank him enough. And the story goes, they went back to town, and this time they did purchase the things they needed. And they came back home, and a wedding date was set. And the entire little shtetl, how many people could have lived in the shtetl? No. People think like the shtetl looked like Fiddler on the Roof with all kinds of different people doing all kinds of different tasks or chores. My dear friends, there were many, many little settlements of Jewish people who lived. Some of them made a living through some farming, and maybe somebody had a mill, or somebody else had a tavern sometimes for guests that would come through. Some of these shtetlach didn't even have a minyan. Some of them had a minyan, a little shul. Not many of these little settlements didn't have a rabbi. They had itinerant preachers who would come by and teach them Torah on occasion. I don't know how big or small the shtetl was, but it was a shtetl. And clearly, there wasn't a big marketplace there. There was no malls. You know? When they needed to buy things to get married, they had to walk a few hours to go to the local larger town. And when there was a wedding, like in Fiddler on the Roof, the whole shtetl participated. I don't know if there was actually a rabbi in town or not, if they sent for a rabbi, but at any rate, a rabbi was present, and a ketubah was drawn up, and a wedding, and they slaughtered a goat or a sheep, and the whole town participated in preparing for the wedding of this orphan boy and girl, neither of whom had parents, and everybody felt that this was like their personal simcha. Tremendous joy, tremendous happiness, and the villagers felt blessed to be able to do something like this. Within an hour of the chuppah, all of a sudden a carriage shows up, pulls into town, and a very venerable-looking rabbi alights from the wagon, and he says, I received news of the wedding. The chassan, the groom, he is a long-lost nephew of mine. As long as I didn't even know my younger brother died. The whole thing is a shock to my system. I just received word, and I'm here to participate in the wedding. Wow. The orphan boy never knew he had an uncle. He was so shocked, and the uncle hugged him and kissed him, and he said, I'm so happy to be here to celebrate at your wedding. And the next man gets out. He doesn't look as venerable, but also a fine-looking, scholarly man. And he says, he claims to be the uncle of the bride. So I didn't know I have an uncle. No, I'm a great uncle, but I'm an uncle, a miser. And so he was the uncle, and the next one comes out, another rabbi, and he's a cousin of the chassan, and a fourth rabbi comes out, and he's a cousin of the kallah. So the whole town heard this. You know, it didn't take very long the news to get out, that this bride and groom actually have relatives, and uncles, two uncles are here, and his cousins are in here. And this, of course, energized the simcha, and it was even greater joy and even greater happiness than it was before. And you know, for here, the little wedding scene you saw on Fiddler on the Roof will finally fit perfectly, except there's no pogromity yet.
Everything went very nicely.
It was the custom in Poland, Romania, the area called Bessarabia, probably parts of Ukraine also. The custom was that at a wedding, all the wedding gifts would be announced. And this was this way everybody who came, it actually was a young couples would be able to start their lives. When were they going to get the equivalent of today, $50,000? How do you start life off? So everybody would give. These weren't wealthy people, but everybody in the shtetl would give. They would give something. And that's how young couples would start a life off. This is how it was. What would they give? Oftentimes they didn't have extra money. One had an extra pillow. And people would save, pluck chickens and save the feathers. They give a feather pillow. And somebody else would give maybe, say, if somebody was raising goats, he had an extra goat, he'd give them a goat. And somebody else might give a blanket, somebody else might give a pot. People gave different gifts. Sometimes it was new gifts, sometimes used gifts. Everybody gave. This is how it was. This is how Yidden lived. They lived generously. They gave freely. And people cared about each other. So it came to the time to announce the gifts. They said to the uncle, what are you going to give? You have to announce the gift. So the uncle said, announce that I am giving the village, that village where people go shopping, that village belongs to the Duke. And, you know, all the stores and the shops are leased, of course. I give the village, that parcel of land, that whole area, that little tiny municipality, I gift it to the Qasim. Everybody burst out laughing. It was ridiculous. You give them, how do you give the Duke's village? They thought the man is probably destitute. He doesn't have any money. He's being nice. What should he? He's making a joke. So it was very funny. So everybody laughed. It was humorous. And they went to the uncle, the purported uncle of the Kala, said, what do you give? He says, I am going to give. There's a mill not far away from here. And the mill belongs to this particular Duke. And I'm giving the mill. Give me the mill. It's ridiculous. Huh? And so it was. And the next one, the cousin, he said he's giving the river. There was a little river. And people would pay, I suppose, a fee to go fishing there. He's giving the little river, little stream. And the other one said he was giving a field. There's a field over there, a little farm. He's giving them a homestead. Okay, it was very humorous. It was very strange in the villagers' eyes. But people took it with a sense of humor. And that's how it was. The wedding came to its conclusion. And as they say, everything was happily ever after. The never before seen uncles got back into their carriage with the cousins. And they rode off in the dead of the night. And nobody was wiser. And nobody ever saw anybody again, and that was the end of the story. Now, this very, very generous employer, I guess he was the wealthiest person in town, he felt that the need to do something to help this couple, you know, have to start life off. So he gave him an option of employment, opening up like a little satellite of whatever he was doing. And he had some kind of farm, some kind of a... And he gave them, the people in town arranged. It was a little bit further away from the town in an isolated place. But there you can start up and, you know, maybe you work your way up and eventually be able to move back to town. Anyway, the young woman were delighted with each other. They were just so happy to be married to each other. And they were so thankful to the villagers to have them provided for them. And they went off to their way and they began their life together. And they both worked hard and, you know, they put bread on the table. One night, in the dead of the night, there's a knock on the door. It's late, maybe 9 or 10 o'clock at night in the winter. There's furious knocking on the door. The young man opens the door, and there he sees a fellow wearing hunting garb. His eyes are bloodshot. His face is blue with cold. And he's near exhaustion, about to collapse. And he begins to speak as quickly as he can, and the words are tumbling out of his mouth, and the young orphan can make some sense out of what's going on. Apparently, there's a son of a local duke, and he went hunting, and it's winter, and the carriage had gone over an area that was covered with ice, and they didn't realize it wasn't on the actual road, and the ice had broken, and they fell into a deep ravine that was filled with ice and water. And the horse was there, and the wagon had fallen there, and the young Duke could not extricate himself. And he had worked for hours, and barely managed to pull himself out of this, and he was looking for help. He said, my master, the young prince, is going to freeze to death. He's going to freeze to death. I don't even know if he's alive anymore. The young man put on his large woolen boots, like big socks. When I was in Russia, I saw this. It's called volikas. Today they have little galoshes on top of them. Those days just wore like his big heavy wool socks, wool boots. And he put on his fur jacket and his fur hat, the shapka. He took the largest lantern he could find, and you know, he was a sturdy young fellow. He took rope, and I guess what you would, the equivalent of today's day, bungee cords or whatever else it was, the things you need to try to pull something like this off. He had some basic tools, and he went off. He went off with his servant, and they found the ravine, and the young man did a yeoman's job, and with tremendous effort, he managed to schlep this guy out of the pit, and the young man was barely alive. The young prince was barely alive, and he schlepped him. He schlepped him back to his house. And in the meantime, the young woman, the young orphan wife, had made her prepared some porridge, and they brought the alcohol, and they rubbed his body with alcohol, and they wrapped him in blankets, and he spent the night in that house. And the next day, they left. Of course, the duke was going out of his mind, terrified of what had happened to his son. He was overjoyed to see his son, and they brought in a local medical team, and the doctor said he would be okay, and he wouldn't even lose his fingers and his toes, despite the frostbite. It would take him a few weeks to recover, and with good rest and care, in a few weeks he'd be back to himself. And so it was. In a few weeks, he was back to himself, and the duke, who was delirious with joy that his son had been saved, threw a ball. You know, these dukes are not very busy people. These dukes and the ladies, whatever, they went to parties, threw a huge ball, invited all the local nobility from far and wide, and the guests of honor. Well, the guests of honor, these people were no special lovers of the Jewish people, but still, you had to appreciate what this orphan boy and orphan girl, they saved their son's life. They were the guests of honor. In that part of the world, alcohol flows freely. I'm not talking about Baltanura, you know, that's like ginger ale for these people. They drink hard ale or hard vodka, and that's how you party. And the party, you know, that it was intense. A lot of drinking, very, 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 a very heavy party, as they say. They partied heavy. And somewhere in the middle of the night, the duke got up and he said, "I am ever grateful to this young couple, and I am going to award them a prize for saving my son." He said, "There's a little village, and I own the rights to everything in that village, and I gift this village." Now, of course, unbeknownst to this young man and woman, at the wedding, it wasn't an uncle who showed up. It was the holy Baal Shem Tov. And it was not cousins or uncles of the Kala. These were three Talmidei HaBaal Shem Tov that the Baal Shem Tov took along with him. All great tzaddikim. And the duke gifts the village, the very same village that the Baal Shem Tov had gifted at the wedding, the duke gifts the village to this young couple. And after that, the next duke gets up and he's drunk out of his head, and he doesn't want to be outdone, not to be outdone. He says, "I'm so grateful, my best friend's only son. This is a very, very, very big deal. I have many mills." Says one mill less is not going to make me. It's not going to make me or break me. The mill that I own, and it was the very mill that the Talmud of the Baal Shem Tov had given to the Kala. He said, "The very mill. I gift the mill to this couple." And so it was. The next duke gifted the brook, and the next duke gifted the farm, the homestead, and this was the. This is how the party ended. And as the Baal Shem Tov later explained, that in the merit of the tzedakah that this young couple gave, they gave everything away, such mesiras nefesh, you know, a young orphan, young orphan children, and here they are, and they had a few dollars, which they never could have anticipated or expected, and they gave it all away to save a family. The Baal Shem Tov said, in the merit of this, that's why Hashem had paid them back, and that's why they did indeed live happily ever after. This is the story. So, as I said, it's a story which is a little bit related to the time, because there's this idea of, during an epidemic, of making a wedding for orphans. There is such a concept, and it's a very big schus, and it's a tremendous mitzvah, obviously. But I'm saying the story a little more specifically because I wanted to share with you a teaching of the Baal Shem Tov, as the Rebbe elucidated. The teaching of the Baal Shem Tov on the Pirkei Avot that we just read together a short while ago after Mincha. In the third chapter of Pirkei Avot, we say that we open with this idea that in the end we'll have to give, it says, Din v'cheshbon. In the end, we're going to have to give a ruling and an accounting. And Akavi ben Mahal says, you should think about that. You know, you're going to have to give a ruling and accounting. Dalef ne'mi ata asid litin din v'cheshbon. Know before whom. See it in your mind's eye. Know before whom you will someday have to give a ruling and accounting. A din and a cheshbon. So obviously, the word din and cheshbon is a little out of place there because first comes an accounting and then comes a final resolution. It should say cheshbon and din. The din is the final word. But first you have to look at the facts. You have to analyze things. Only when you analyze things, as they say, when you add everything up, then you can hit the final tally. Then you know what the actual result is. So why here would we have it kind of backwards? Very strange thing. So there's various explanations that are given. This is Jumta speaks about it, but the Rebbe suggested that the way we could understand this idea of din or din b'cheshbon is based on a teaching of the Baal Shem Tov later on in the chapter. In the 16th Mishnah, we read there that Hashem exacts payment. Nothing goes unnoticed. Everything we do has a result. We're behaving appropriately, there's a cost. We do the right thing, there's remuneration. There's no free lunches, as they say. You pay as you pray. Yeah. doesn't just happen. Things don't just happen. And it says, Nifroyim in Adam midaita, Ushalayim midaita. You pay up. We all pay up. Everybody pays up. There's a calculation. It's midaita. It's from your knowledge. And Shalayim midaita. What does this mean? So the Teferis Yisrael says, midaita. Shalayim midaita means sometimes a person behaves inappropriately financially, and as a result, he's going to lose money. So he made a foolish investment, and then he lost the money. He said, what was I thinking? Why did he make a foolish investment? What was I thinking? And if he thinks about it carefully, he says, it's interesting. The money I lost was exactly the money somebody asked me to give to tzedakah. And I said no then. Oh, see? There's a din v'cheshbon. Sometimes midaita. And sometimes, shalom midaita, it's not something you choose to do. It comes out of the blue. That's how the Tiferes Yisrael explains first the idea of midaita, shalom midaita. But really, it's very hard to understand. What does it mean? Tesis Yom Tov has a different version of the Mishnah. Midaitom, shalom midaitom. The Baal Shem Tov said this. The Baal Shem Tov said that a Yid has to know that in the end, you are the one who is going to make the decisions about yourself. You decide. I decide. That's nice. If I decide, I'll surely judge myself very leniently. We all judge ourselves leniently. We only judge everybody else harshly. I'm not going to judge myself harshly. Baal Shem Tov said it's not so simple. Sometimes midaita, and sometimes you're judging yourself, but you don't realize. How so? This is very simple. You're shown a similar circumstance. A similar circumstance to what you yourself may have done. But we never see it that way when it's us. We only see other people in a harsh light. With for ourselves, everything, we blunt the sharpness of what we did inappropriately. We say, you know, it's not really my fault. If you would be in my shoes, you'd probably do twice as bad. And God knows I meant well. We're very lenient with ourselves. But we see somebody else, we're very quick to point the finger. And we say, that blankety blank, and how dare they, and may they be punished. And we're very, very harsh. We meet out these judgments. And we don't realize that when we're judging somebody else, we're actually judging ourselves. We are the ones who decide on our own verdict. We decide it. We just don't realize it. We decide. When we said it was really bad, he said, okay. He said it was really bad. That's the teaching of the Baal Shem Tov. Midaita shalom midaita. And the Rebbe asked a meridika question. Tremendous question of this teaching. Who are we talking about here? Who's making these judgments? Who in the end is carrying out these verdicts? It's Beis Din Shamayla. This is God's court. God needs you to be the judge. He needs you to say if it was fair or unfair. God knows better. God knows best. Why does God need a person to say? So the person come back and I said, I feel I was judged harshly. They'll tell him, yeah, maybe you were. But guess what? It was all your fault. You gave the judgment. On one hand, it's not even fair. It's not even, maybe if we judge others too harshly, okay, fine. But now I'm getting judged more harshly, and I'm getting judged by God more harshly. That's not fair. I should be judged in accordance with what I did. I should pay the price for my inequity. I shouldn't pay the price for my looking at somebody with a left eye and seeing everything that was wrong in them, even if that itself is wrong. So I have to pay for that. But why should I pay like that? If you think about it, it's a tremendous question. The teaching of the Baal Shem Tov does not seem to add up. It doesn't seem fair at all. And the Rebbe said an unbelievable thing. The Rebbe said that you should know that a Yid has an amazing koyach. Every single Yid is called Yisrael. And the name Yisrael, besides the fact that the Tashbitz Katan was a Talmud of the Rebbe Yehuda HaChassid, the Tashbitz Katan says that has the initials of all the Avos and Imois. But the main thing about Yisrael is not the Avos and Imois per se, whichever Yid has a little bit of them inside him. The main thing is Kisarisa Imelekim Va'anoshim, that you contended and you overcame human and even divine challenges. The name is given to our father Jacob when he wrestles and puts the angel down, when he vanquishes an angel. And the Rebbe says you should know that even Malach Asharis, God's ministering angels, Beis Din Shamayla, has nothing on a Yid. Because every single Yid is neshama that's a piece of God, and that neshama that's literally a chelik elikam imal, it's literally a piece of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Every single neshama is so powerful, even angels can't put him down. There's only one person who can put you down, and that's you. You're the only one. This is the power of a neshama. And now you'll think, I'm not such a big tzaddik. It's okay, maybe not. But you should know that the Gemara tells us, Afal Pisha Chata, even though you sinned, and the word sin, chet, is the gematria, the equivalent of the word chesaron, even though you came up short in life, maybe you're not fulfilling your destiny in life, maybe, but still Yisrael. You still have the properties of Yisrael. In other words, we need to know, my dear friends, that we have tremendous koyach, tremendous power, tremendous potential. It cannot be overestimated, the power of a Yid. Every mitzvah you do is literally, has the power to change the world. It's not a euphemism, it's not poetry, it's not a joke when we say this. We really believe this. We really believe it. And every single Yid, chas v'shalom, when he behaves inappropriately, has the power of making an impact. A negative impact. That's the power. It goes two ways, you know. A sharp knife, it cuts well. It cuts well, but chas v'shalom, if it cuts in the wrong place, it cuts deep also. It's a double-edged sword. The Eibishter gave us tremendous koyach, my friends. And we have to therefore be very careful. We have to be careful to live our lives mindfully and live our lives carefully. You have a chance to daven tomorrow morning. I don't know, maybe we'll be back in shul. Maybe we'll be a miracle overnight. I don't know. Maybe Mashiach is coming right now. But tomer chas v'shalom not. And you have to daven by yourself. You know what, my friends? It doesn't mean your davening is worthless. And when you daven from a siddur, and you daven a little more slowly, you don't have to catch up with a chazan, you don't have to worry about this one talking and that one getting on your nerves. You sit there and you daven with an open heart, and you try to think a little about what you're saying, and I encourage you before davening to learn a little chassidus, take a few time to learn something that elevates you and uplifts you, inspirational teaching of Jewish mysticism. It's a davening. Your davening is a big deal. It's not a little thing. It doesn't matter, you're not with a minyan, you can't be with a minyan, your davening is a big deal, my friends. And if you choose to make a bracha before you eat, it's a big deal. It's a big deal. And you put a nickel, a quarter, a loony, a toony, a $10 bill in the pushkar, it's a big deal. It's a big deal. Don't underestimate it. Everything a yid does is a big deal. I'm not just using words. This is what Torah emet, this is what our Torah of truth tells us. A yid is a very powerful creature. Tremendous koyach. The Eibishter gave us his koyach. We have a koyach with our mouth. have a koyach when we say things, and when we feel things, it makes a difference, my friend. So lately, people are frustrated. I get it. I'm also cooped up. I'm not enjoying this. Nobody's enjoying it. It's not fun for anybody. And when we get cooped up and frustrated, we look for scapegoats. You know, we look to lash out. And especially on Facebook, people lash out at people. They judge people harshly. They trash people. They trash communities, trash individuals, trash ways of life. It's not appropriate. We are Bnei Yisrael. First of all, we have to have Avas Yisrael, as I spoke about a few nights ago. After Avas Yisrael means you judge other people the way you judge yourself. That's the meaning of loving another like yourself in this week's Parsha. Found in Parsha's Kedoshim, Leviticus chapter 19, verse 18. We should have read it together. Couldn't hear it in Shul, unfortunately. We read it on our own today from a Chumash. What does it mean? I spoke about this on Thursday night. It means that we should give somebody else the same benefits we give ourselves. You overlook your own shortcomings. Because you love yourself, love every kid like that. Overlook his shortcomings. Don't be so judgmental, my friends. Don't look at other people in such a negative light. That doesn't mean you have to say bad behavior is okay. Bad behavior is bad behavior. But don't judge the person. Don't judge the person. And there may be a community whose ideology we don't agree with. You don't agree with. I don't agree with. That's fine. That's fine. But the wholesale trashing of communities because you don't agree with their ideology is totally anathema to the Jewish people. It's a terrible thing. It's got to stop. We have to stop. I have to be less judgmental. You have to be less. All of us, we have to be less judgmental. We have to remember, my friends, when we're judging other Yidden, ultimately, whether you like it or not, you're pointing a judgment upon yourself. Like one wise person says, you point one finger at somebody, you got a bunch of fingers pointing at yourself. So let us find room in our hearts to love other Yidden who we don't agree with, who have ideologies which we find offensive, who do things which enrage us and make us upset, that the behavior is wrong and it should be condemned, but without hate and without anger, without acrimony, without judgmentalness. You could say, Nebuch, how sad, how misguided, how foolish these people are. So sad. So sad is very different than saying how evil or so bad. So bad, so evil is not the same as so sad and so inappropriate. So we should try to do the right thing, and we definitely have to know the difference is right or wrong. I'm not saying to be confused right or wrong, and I'm not saying to give wrong behavior a pass, and I'm not saying chasom to engage in wrong behavior. I'm just telling you the outlook and the judgmental words that sometimes spill from our mouth is something we have to be careful about. And hopefully, if we all have a little more avas yisrael, a little more love for our fellow, and we're a little less captious and fault-finding, and a little more generous, the way we look at others, the Eibushter will make Hashem be a little more generous to us, and He will bless us with the things that we want and hope. And we'll be able to come together soon, be reunited. We shouldn't have to be physically separated and apart. And we should be zeicher Meretz Hashem that the greatest blessing of all, the greatest blessing of all, is not the end of Corona or a booming economy, or even good health and happiness from our families. The greatest blessing, my friends, the greatest hope, our greatest dream, and our greatest aspiration and our yearning is to be for the coming of Mashiach. May it be a Meretz Hashem, speedily, in our time, hopefully, in this new Freilich week, when Heda will be Ameinu, Amen. Agutavach Shavuot Tov.